We went back and cuddled and kissed, and it was gorgeous. Then I woke up and I just touched my boxers, and like they weren't even like, it was just like literally had leaked right through and leaked out. And he had a white duvet and white sheets.
Oh, no.
It was literally like, it was everywhere to the point where I was like, he might even need on a mattress. Do you know that kind of way? Like it had leaked everywhere.
Welcome to Doing It with me, Hannah Witten, where we talk all things sex, relationships, dating, and our bodies. Hi, welcome back to Doing It. I hope that you are well. I'm continuing to plod along, and that's the best description that I currently have of my lockdown experience. This episode is a special one for me because I got to talk about not just one, but two of my specialty subjects, sex and poo. Yep, you heard right, poo. My guest this week is Chris Moore, who is a YA author, and he writes about LGBTQ plus issues and chronic illness. Chris gets into his specific diagnosis and health journey in the episode, but there's a crossover in mine and Chris's experiences in that we've both had our large intestines removed and Chris had a stoma at 1.2. And as you'll hear, Chris is also not shy about talking about poo. In this episode, we talk about his illness, his surgeries as a teenager, whilst also discovering his sexuality and trying to have normal teenage experiences. Chris shares about his struggles with body image because of his scars and stoma, with the added pressure around having a perfectly masculine body from gay culture. We also get into the expectations of sexual roles because of your gender and sexuality and how it plays out in relationships if you're physically limited and unable to do some sexual acts, like not be able to receive anal sex, for example. We chat about Chris's dating experiences, and I finally get to ask someone the question that has been haunting me for years. How does someone with a penis empty their stoma bag? Really important question. Thanks so much to Chris for being a brilliant guest. His book, Gut Feelings, is out now. It is a verse novel all about his experiences with chronic illness and sexuality, and I would highly recommend checking it out. As usual, you can find more information and links to everything we talked about in this episode in the show notes over at doingitpodcast.co.uk. And please let us know what you think over on our Twitter or Instagram at doingitpodcast. If you like this podcast, please give us a rating and review over on iTunes. It is really, really appreciated. And without further ado, here is Chris Moore. Welcome, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. I've got coffee, so I'm always doing well with coffee.
Oh, nice. Necessary. So we're going to get into lots of detail around your story. But first, I think maybe it would be a good idea for you to give us like a medical history backstory, like quick fire. So we all know what we're talking about.
Sure. So yeah, I don't know if I can do quick, but I will try.
yeah.
The official name for the diagnosis of my chronic illness is familial adenomatous polyposis. So familial, wow, being that it's genetic. So my granddad had it, my mum had it, I have it. And if I did have biological kids, there would be a 50% chance that they would have it. So it's caused by a gene mutation on the APC gene. And then that's carried down from obviously from my granddad to my mum to me, and then if I had kids to my kids. And what actually happens is it's where adenomas or polyps grow on the inside of the large intestine. So they're kind of like, if you imagine, like if you've ever gotten a wart on your finger, you'd expect to maybe see, you know, couple of dozen, maybe a few dozen, maybe even 100. I believe that I had hundreds, if not thousands.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, and they were already starting to turn. So they're pre-cancerous, but they do turn cancerous. And I think websites usually like Macmillan and Irish Cancer Society, they say that when you are, by the time you're 40, they can turn cancerous. I was told that basically I'd be dead by 21 if I didn't get my surgeries.
And you were like 12, 13 when they told you that?
I was 11 when I was diagnosed.
You were 11?
Yeah,
oh, wow.
So I was 11 years old. I hadn't even hit puberty. I was like looking at those sort of like festive magazines where like, you know, you were like, oh, look at the men. I was that boy and I was like, pretend you're looking at the woman, you know, pretend you're looking at page 3. be a man, like all this kind of jargon and nonsense. When I was 13, I had my large intestine completely removed, and I couldn't eat for like 6 days. And everyone kept bringing up Cadbury cream eggs, which is a bit weird because like I loved Cadbury cream eggs, but when you've got like 80 Cadbury cream eggs on your stand and you can't eat them, it's a bit weird, you know?
That's torture.
It was so bad. I ended up giving them away. I have never been a fan of Cadbury cream eggs since, just because there were so many.
Yeah, you're just like, I can't look at them anymore.
No, definitely. And so then like basically, like I guess I'll try and condense this down and give you the cliff notes. So when I was 17, I had like the lining of the rectum removed, and they attached that to the ilium or the small intestine. And because of the shape, they traditionally call it a J pouch. But in order to like let the stitches kind of heal, they have to give you an ileostomy. So it's an ileostomy, obviously, because of the small intestine, the ilium, that part that they take out, still a stoma. So I had that. So I actually had that when I was at university. I was in second year, so I was 17, and then I just turned 18 over the summer when I went into second year, when I had to get the reversal at Christmas. But when I had it done, there was kind of a few complications. I had like a fascia, is what they call it. So it's where the scar tissue heals over the skin, and it kind of created a dip. So for a long time,
because in your book, because I was reading your book and you talk about like the black hole scar. Is that what that is?
It's basically because when they had to, like when I was at home, we had to get like a nurse to come over. So I had to lie in bed and like, even when I was at home, and this is like 2 weeks after the surgery, there was like a hole underneath the skin. It kind of went like, instead of going down, it kind of went under at like an angle, like a sort of 30 degree angle under the skin. So they had to keep packing it with these silver strips to absorb, because it was infected. They had to absorb the pus and all that kind of nastiness. And that's the way that it healed. It healed like a dip. It almost, I always like try to think like it's the only thing I've taken from sort of 5 years of geography, which is like, you know, the V-shaped valley, if you look at like the cross section, that dip.
Right, I'm trying to imagine it, but I'm so struggling.
Did you do geography, Hannah?
I stopped geography at 14, so there's probably not a lot of memory
like
in my
head. A V, like a hole, but like if you looked at it, like, and you kind of, it would just be like a V. But it was hard. Yeah, I didn't. It wasn't fun.
Especially like as a teenager at uni, that's so hard.
Yeah, and I wasn't out to my family, and I feel like I was always kind of uncomfortable in my body. I feel like gay men growing up like generally have this expectation. Like when we see pictures of people, we see like the six pack and the oil skin and the sort of like, you know, we see expectations, like kind of expectations of almost like sort of that gym fit body, or like, you know, Insta body, and the sort of going to the gym and that sort of masculine expectation, which obviously doesn't help because you see it everywhere. I think it's a bit better now in terms of representation of different like people kind of coming out, but at the time it was like, this is 12 years ago. It was quite tough to try and just like figure myself out, and then the illness and the trauma of that I was obviously not dealing very well with, you know. Dealing with it's very
like,
well.
There's so much to handle like at that age, because like I was ill for a lot of my like teenage, kind of like that same like kid, tween and teenage years as well, but I also had a lot of time being healthy, but then also didn't have to deal with figuring out my sexuality, because I kind of like fit the straight box. And I was wondering, because it got me reading your book, got me thinking that being ill as a teenager, you feel like you miss out on lots of like key social or sexual like dating milestones, like all of these things of like, oh, that's what it's like to be a teenager, like that's like a quintessential teenage experience, and if you're ill you miss out on it. But then also like a lot of LGBTQ+ kids also feel like they miss out on it, because they're having to hide who they are through potentially when they're that age. Does that like resonate with you? Do you was that what it was like?
Yeah, so I guess for me, like, so I had my surgery when I was 13, and up until then I'd been swimming since kind of I was able to walk, you know. I was like stuck in, I remember like being in the pool and you hold onto the ring and you kind of can't really kick your legs because you're so young, and I kind of remember like not really, they kind of drag you across. But I used to swim, and like I was getting ready to sort of like almost compete, you know, in actual proper like races in Ireland. And when I had the surgery, I wouldn't get back into the water, you know. I completely gave up on that. I didn't want to be seen. I didn't want people to see my scar. And the scar, to be fair, wasn't that bad, but it was bad to me. And then, so I had that, and I kind of retreated a little bit. And I suppose like kind of became a bit more, like at that time, I became a bit more isolated, a bit more of a gamer, didn't really have many friends. And then like my dad had the brain injury then around the same time, like just before. And so obviously like he was in and out of hospitals for like, well, he was in hospital for the best part of a year and in a rehabilitation center. Because even when he had his, you know, even months down the line, we'd go in and say, you know, where are you today, dad? And he's like, oh, the circus. And he'd be in a white room with a bed. And it was just kind of crazy. So I was going through that as well. And I remember when we had like sort of therapy as a family, which didn't really go great, since you've read the book. Everyone just kind of shouts, you know, and whoever's the loudest is wins, but no one hears anyone. And they said, like, you know, well, would you like to have, you know, would you like to do kind of group therapy with your kind of people more your age? And I did. And there was this girl, and like, I just kind of went for it, and we kissed each other and stuff like that. But it was very forced, and I knew I didn't want to kiss her, and there was that expectation of like your first kiss. But then, as you said, as an LGBTQ person, and I don't know if people will resonate with that, like other LGBTQ people, where like you kiss someone that you know you don't want to kiss, but you're trying to like be what people expect you to be rather than what who you actually are. So I think I'm
have those teenage experiences.
Yeah, and have that awkwardness and that, like, you know, like I do miss that. I feel like I've so much respect, you know, when you see like younger sort of people that like are coming out now, and you just see them holding hands, and I'm just like I just want to go up and just like give them a hug, and they'd be like, there's a 10, like, go get yourself some cocktails. Although maybe not 13. Like, go get yourself some chocolate.
I mean, I wasn't at school like that long ago in the grand scheme of things. And like, no kid was out in my year of my school, like no one. And that to me, like, is so like wild when I think about it. Cause I was just like, this was in the 2000s, and no one.
So we had like 500 or 600 people at our school, and there was like maybe one that we knew was gay, and the rest we didn't. And I was like bullied mercilessly, and I was called gay before I knew what gay meant, like, really, you know. And because gay also, like, very much so, I don't know about British culture, because I obviously grew up in the Irish education system, but we sort of like said, oh, that's gay, this is gay, as in like it's lame or uncool. And I just like was like, oh, this is really something that you should hide, like this is something you shouldn't be this. But also I was like the kind of like, especially when I went into like the year above, I skipped my transition year, my fourth year that we do in Ireland, where it's kind of like an in-between year. I skipped it. So I was like, I think I was 16 when I did my leaving certificate. I think it's the equivalent of your A levels. But I was quite smart, and I was really good at like biology and stuff like that. And I'd get like really, really good marks. And I used to be bullied because of that as well. So I don't know if it was that they thought I was gay, because I was quite quiet at school, which is hard to believe now that I'm like sitting here and chatting. But like,
it was just an insult that was thrown at anyone different as well.
No, definitely. Yeah. And like, I remember like as well when I did kiss this particular girl, and I was like, oh, this is, you know, this is her name. And I finally did it, and it was like almost like, you know, like an achievement, an accomplishment, like almost almost like a scout's badge that you can wear for the boys. And it's like, yeah, you know, like a weird,
I kissed a girl.
It kind of reminded me of that. It's like, kiss the first girl, got the, you know, got the second, third base kind of thing or whatever. But like, I remember they were just like, you're making that up. And I was like, oh my God, I went through all of that.
and they don't even believe you.
I know. I was just like, oh, whatever.
You might as well have just made it up.
I know. I wasn't pretty good liar, though, to be fair. Mm-hmm. Like, I was, you know what I mean? I was the sort of person that would, like, probably there'd be, like, a dragon in the story that I made up or something stupid and a castle and a princess, and I'd just, like, they'd be like, no.
Love that. Always meant to be a writer, then.
Always meant to be a writer.
Right, so I have a question, right? I've had this for years, and, well, for the last 3 years since I've had a stoma. And I haven't thought about, I keep forgetting to ask people this. And then when I was reading your book, I was like, oh shit, must ask Chris this question. So when I first got my stoma back and when I was like at home from hospital, one of the things that me and my partner did was so that he could kind of like understand what it was like a bit for me to have a stoma bag, I stuck a stoma bag to his body in a place where it probably would be.
And so
he, like, you know, sat down on the toilet and like moved around a bit and put like a t-shirt on to kind of like see how it felt. And he sat down on the toilet and was just like, wait, how am I supposed to do this? Like, how do I not get shit on my dick? And I was like, oh, good point. I don't have that problem. I just spread my legs and like, and then and then squeeze the output out of the stoma. So I just need to know, how do you not get shit on your dick?
That's a really interesting question. I was not expecting that. I didn't know where this was going. I was like,
it's a really highbrow question.
I know, this is a winding road and I don't know where it leads into the dark forest. Quite literally, possibly, the way that this question's been interpreted. I mean, off the top of my head, I think that because I was quite tall, I was like when I was 12, I think I was the height that I am now. Like, I shot up at 12, 13.
Wow.
So I was about 6 foot, so, or even like maybe 5'11". So I used to kneel down, and I used to spend a lot of time at home or at university. So I had to be quite cautious about like, guys, piss everywhere, so just like,
yeah,
be careful where you kneel down, and you know, maybe like clean a little bit, bring your bottle of Dettol, and just, you know.
That's so interesting. I hadn't thought about that, because I did at one point try and see if I could empty my stoma bag while standing over the toilet, and then decided that that was not the method for me and I was going to stay sat down. But yeah, kneeling.
Yeah, I used to kneel beside it and then just put the toilet seat up and then just kind of, yeah.
It's fascinating. I wonder if lots of people with penises do that method, or if there's a variation out there. Please let me know. Listeners, I'm so curious. Ever since Dan asked that, I was like, I don't. How do you not get shit on the dick? Oh my god! Yeah, these are the questions that I have for you know, I've been sitting on that question for 3 years since Dan asked me. I've not had a chance to ask anyone yet.
Well, you've got your first answer.
There we go. Love it. Thank you. So I wanted to ask, what for you do you think has been the biggest impact on your body image and on your sex life in terms of being ill and having surgery? Like, what's had the biggest impact?
So I guess there's two things that have affected it. One of them is the actual scar. So the scar that I had after the second surgery, because it healed so badly. If people were trying to touch me in bed or cuddle up to me and they put their arm around me, I would like smack their arm away. Mm. I wouldn't want anyone to touch me. I used to wrap the covers around myself. I didn't, even when I was big spoon, I didn't like spooning somebody, because it almost felt like it had its own heartbeat. It was pulsing. It was this horrible thing that I couldn't even look at myself in the mirror, and I couldn't accept it. And I remember like my first real boyfriend being like, I don't have an issue with it. And I was like, but I do. You know, like, you don't understand how I feel with you touching me. It's not about that you're okay with it. It's about that I'm not okay with it. And really, I should have had some therapy at that point to kind of really like help me through that, because I was obviously still going through a bit of the trauma, because it had only been a couple of years after I'd had the surgery where I had my first boyfriend when I was like 20. But the second one, I guess, is because I've had the lining of the rectum removed and had that kind of you know, that all attached to the ileum and the anus. In gay sex, you're either like top or bottom, or sometimes first. So when I remember, like, I've had relationships where they've just like, as soon as you ask the question, are you top or bottom, and it's like, I'm top. And then they're like, oh, well, I'll make you bottom. And it's like, oh, not going to work like that. You know, that's not going to happen.
Not physically possible.
Yeah, because obviously, like, I'll hemorrhage because the stitches, it will impact that.
And no one wants that.
Yeah, and that was really tough because it was like, you meet these people that were, like, really good guys. But obviously, like, if I couldn't expect them to do something they're not comfortable with either. So it's always been like, I mean, I'm like 30 and single, and like, I guess some of that, I think a lot of that in my 20s had to do with like, not really, until I kind of wrote this book, I guess, like in my later 20s, it was like, I didn't really process any of what I'd been through. I think I just like pushed it to the back of my mind. And when I wrote this, it was like, okay, well, this is me. This is like, you know, if I meet somebody, and I guess as well, like in gay culture, it's kind of like people are like, some people are very like rigid. Like some people are very like, oh no, I'm versatile, kind of go with the flow. Some people are like, I'm only a top or I'm only a bottom, and they won't compromise. And it's very like, you know, when you're talking to someone, like I feel like in a straight relationship, you talk to someone, you get to know them, and like it's a guy and a girl, and like that would never really be an issue, right? Because then it's like when you get to the bedroom, there might be some things that you like and some things that your partner doesn't like, but those two compatible like jigsaw pieces kind of have to work.
Well, it's an interesting one because I feel like, I think the rigidity of like roles and sex is very much there in straight relationships too. It's just like person with the dick is the top, person with the vag is the bottom.
Yeah.
And there's again, like similarly, there's like no room for any experimentation beyond that, really.
No,
it's like,
of course.
What if I want to wear the dick?
Yeah, no, true. No, that's fair. I didn't really think about that actually. But
not a lot of straight people do. They just kind of like accept the role that has been given them.
Fair. And like, I suppose as well, there are people that like don't like anal sex at all, and they don't have that. And that's like perfectly fine too, you know, that way. Like, I don't think it's the be all end all, you know, that way. And like, if I'm with somebody, like, I really like to get to know them, because it's such a big issue for me in many ways. Like, not be like, I've worked through everything, but it's still important to me, so I have to have that like that connection, I guess.
And because you had your surgery like when you were much younger, so like before you were sexually active, do you feel, I guess, like maybe it's the wrong word, but like any sense of loss that decision was made for you?
Yes.
In terms of being able to experience different kinds of sex?
No, yes and no. I think like the younger me was completely against the idea of bottoming. And I think that really had to do with like, I was traumatized by enemas when I was younger. Like,
oh, same.
I was 12, I had the enema. And I remember they were like, it's going to be just like jelly. And there's a poem in the book called Just Like Jelly. And it kind of resonates throughout the surgeries. And it was like, it's not like jelly, because jelly is like raspberry and strawberry and like lemon goodness, you know.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, jelly is also kind of like disgusting when you think about what it's made of, but like, it's not, you know, they're not like getting a, you know, sticking a syringe full of jelly up your bum. It doesn't go up your bum. Jelly doesn't go up your bum. So don't say it's just like jelly.
Don't put jelly up your bum.
It doesn't feel like that, you know, like, we're gonna make that hashtag, Hannah, jelly up your bum. But yeah, like it was that idea, I guess, that made me not want to bottom. But then like later in life, I'm like, do you know what? Like, I would have loved to have that decision be mine. I would have liked to be with someone. And like, you know, when you're like, you have that connection with somebody and it's like just there, and it's like that moment to try. It's almost like trying, you know, like with the first time you kind of have sex, it's almost like that over again, because it's a completely different experience. It's completely different. And and in many ways, like, obviously it kind of goes back to the idea of someone being the top, being dominant, and someone being submissive, being the bottom. But I guess, as you know, you can play around with those roles. But for me, it would have been interesting to sort of be more submissive in that role, where I really just, I can't, you know, like I can in terms of like the top box, if you like, or the active box, but I can never bottom.
It's so weird how, this is going to sound so strange, but I really relate to what you're saying. And I think it's because, so I've and this is something that I've never really spoken about, but I've never had anal sex, and I've never like really been interested. And I think it's kind of like similar to what you're saying. I've got a lot of trauma around my butthole, especially to do with enemas. But when I was in my mid-20s, something kind of shifted for me. And I was just like, oh, I actually feel ready to experiment sexually with my bum, right? I was like in a place where I was like, I'm not going to go like straight in for anal sex, but I'm like ready to kind of explore to see if this could be an erogenous zone for me. And then a few months later, got ill and had my surgery and had my colon removed. I was just like, what? Like, made that decision, decided I was like actually keen, and then it got taken away from me.
And it's like, it sucks, because it's like you kind of feel like when you're with somebody, you're limiting them, but also you've kind of got that with yourself. You feel like you're not getting to fully enjoy like your sexual experience or to play with it. And it kind of does narrow a lot of the options for you because of that. Like, I've had, I remember like once I was with this guy, and I remember saying like, you know, he stuck his finger at my bum, and I was just like, all right, or bumhole, as we like to say on the podcast. And I remember just saying like, seriously, like, I don't enjoy that, because it just immediately reminded me, and it didn't even feel like good. It just reminded me of the enema. And I was like, no. And he kept doing it. And I was like, okay. And he's like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm getting dressed. I'm going home. Like, I'm not here for this. I was like, I am totally turned off. I said, if you like, you completely managed to turn me off. Like, congratulations. Like, yeah. I didn't say it quite like that. I was probably a bit soft. That's not like my sassy 30-year-old self, but like, yeah.
In my mid-20s. I wish we could be like that in those moments.
I really do. It's like, I told you no. No means no, you know.
yeah wow. I also wanted to ask, because you also talk about this in the book, is leakages.
Yes.
How has that been? And then also, I kind of have a logistical question, because I might have got the timeline wrong, but the leakages that you had weren't with a stoma, it was with your J pouch.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or no.
It was with the J pouch. It wasn't with the stoma. No, yeah, you're right.
How does that work? Is it because the J pouch doesn't have as much control as like a traditional colon and rectum, so output could come out without you controlling it? Is that why?
Yeah, like your muscles aren't as strong, you know, as if, because you've had all these invasive surgeries. And like, I have this really bad habit at the moment of ordering sweet corn and tomato pizzas from Domino's, which is like the worst thing ever. And I like eat them at 9 o'clock, and you're like, Chris, look, you've had this for like 17 years. Like, you should know better. Like, you know, but I don't know better. But yeah, like I have had leakages. Like, there was two in particular that I remember. So there was one leakage, and it was this guy, and I was in like, so picture like this kind of like, you know, you're young, and like it's a bit of a dive bar. Like, it's in Dublin, and it's in like the George and stuff like that. It's gorgeous, but it's also like, you know, a bit dark or whatever. And you kind of like, I was there, and there's all these kind of guys, and I was looking at them, they're looking at me. But in my heart of hearts, I was like, I'd met this other guy a few weeks ago and really liked him, and I was texting him because I was thinking about him. And you know, he's a lovely guy, and he was a nurse, and I was like, great, like, I'm gonna just get the taxi back to him, and I'm gonna cuddle, it's gonna be so nice. And we went back and cuddled and kissed, and it was gorgeous. Then I woke up, and I just touched my boxers, and like, they weren't even like, it was just like, literally had leaked right through and leaked out. And he had a white duvet and white sheets.
Oh, no.
It was literally like, it was everywhere, to the point where I was like, he might even need on a mattress. Do you know that kind of way? Like, it had leaked everywhere.
Oh, yeah. I've got shit stain on my mattress.
I had to like, well, this was like, this was definitely going to be a massive one. Like, I was just like, shit, no pun intended. And I remember him like, just, I had to wake him up, and it took forever to wake up. And I was like, I can't even walk to the toilet because it will just go everywhere. And I remember being in the toilet and just ordering like the taxi, and just being like, when I get into taxi, just please don't say anything. It will break me if you say anything about a smell or anything like that. I was like, because I remember like, I literally had to throw the boxers out. I was went home without wearing boxers, so I had to clean myself as best I could. I felt so dirty. And then there was another time where I was in London, and like there was a guy that I was dating, and like I had a leakage, and luckily like I managed to like kind of, it was like on a part of the covers that I could kind of like get rid of, or like at least mm-hmm. put to the side so that he wouldn't see, kind of thing. And I was like, thank God for that. I was just like, oh, such a close call. And it is something that I think about, because when you're have like, when you, it, like, I couldn't be always sexually spontaneous, because I'd have to completely like control what I eat and like make sure that I'm not having anything too fibrous. And do you know what I mean? Like, and people, like when they cook me meals and I don't eat parts of it, and they're like, oh, why not? And it's like, well, you've made me this nice meal, but actually later on when we go to like Funky Town, like we're not going to quite get there, because I'm going to be afraid of like shitting myself. And then they're like, like, you know, like when you like, you want to like strip down, and like, and gay guys are always like, well, not all gay guys, I don't want to like typecast us, but like they're always like, oh, I just want to like sleep without my boxers on, like, and I'm like, oh, I want to see like boxers on and then pajama bottoms, and they're like, what? And I'm like, yeah, I'm like literally like, I'll wear boxers and then shorts, and I'm just like, they're like, are you cold? And I'm like, yeah. They're like, I can put the heat in. And I was like, please don't put the heat. And I was like, 40 degrees already, and I cannot take these off. Like, I'm really sweating.
Yeah. Oh, it's a lot, because then there's also just like the fear of it happening as well. Just yeah. Like,
oh. It's like when someone says, oh, like, do you know, like when, like, because like, I feel like we've all like kind of been there where you're in a club and you're younger and someone's like, oh, do you want to go home? Like, oh, do you want to come back with me? Like, you're kissing all night and you're holding each other's hands. And then you're like, no. It's just like pretty shit.
Yeah, I feel like maybe the equivalent would be like if you're on your period, but that also doesn't stop people. And that's like fair game.
Yeah.
We had some questions for you from some of our followers on Instagram, which I want to put to you now, if that's all right. That's
absolutely fine. Excited and terrified.
Someone asked, did being ill as a teenager delay your understanding of your sexuality?
Definitely. So for me, I was, so like, it wasn't just that, like, so basically my family was like divided kind of from the age of like around when I was 12, because my dad had a brain injury, and that really went on for like a good couple of years, as in like the actual in and out of hospitals and stuff like that. And that was all going on, and I was in one hospital, my dad was in another hospital in another part of Dublin, so my mom had to drive back and forth. And to be honest with you, like, the last thing that was on my mind, it's like there was so much that I was trying to deal with my dad. Like, so when my dad went into hospital, we were brought up to see him, and he was in a coma, and they said to us, you know, I learned afterwards, my mom said that the nurse had told her, like, you know, you might want to let the kid say goodbye. So then after that, I'd gone in to have this other surgery, and he'd come out of the coma, and that was really like, it was so difficult to understand what it meant to be gay, because the only thing I had was like, you know, trying to go on the internet, and we had like a family computer, so trying to like scroll, you know, like half naked boys, and like be like, why am I getting a Woody, you know, like it was just Yeah.
And whilst all this other stuff is happening in your life and with your health and with your family, like, oof.
No, definitely. It was like, I recognize it now that there was definitely like a sense of trauma around everything I'd been through. But my mind, I was like 11 when I'd been told this, and then 13 when I had the surgery, 12 when my dad went in and had had the brain hemorrhage. So this all came really quite in those formative years, almost, I feel like, where you start to learn about sex education.
Yeah. And you're just like, brain is not ready for
this information. I do remember though, I was at like a barbecue where, like, before, I think it was before I went into surgery, I remember like just, there was this guy, this older man, and I remember just going, he's so handsome. And I'm just like, obviously I cannot stand up and meet anybody because I, quite excited, and I don't know why, and I can't process this feeling because I'm out here beside my dad who can't even really properly see us, like, and there's all these issues going on. It was just a really conflicting feeling.
Yeah, what a weird time. Somebody asked, how did you tell people, or even like present tense, how do you tell people your age, like your peers, about your illness, I guess, if you're meeting them for the first time?
So like, I kind of like not, I don't really shy away from the fact that, like, you know, people ask me, like, what do you do? And I'm kind of like, oh, like, I write books and I teach. And they're like, oh, what are the books about? And then I mention the chronic illness, and then they ask me. And now I say, well, look, this is my illness and this is what it does. And I don't mm-hmm. always say, oh, by the way, I can only talk. I don't say that. A lot of them, a lot of them are quite smart in terms of, like, they kind of get it.
Figure it out.
And if they ask me, then I'll be, like, very honest. But it is quite, like, it's something I own as part of my story. And, like, I guess, like, if I'm dating, that's kind of what I do. I'm quite open as well. Like, my housemates that I live with and stuff will ask me questions, and I'm very, very open about it. Before, I found it very difficult because I feel like before I wrote the book, I didn't really fully understand. There was all these medical terms that were thrown around, like dysplasia, which, mm-hmm. you know, is just how the sort of polyps start to turn cancerous, like whether it's sort of mild or moderate, or it's kind of gone on to a point where it is become cancerous. But mm-hmm. everything was medical terms, so I couldn't really understand it. And I think I was trying to understand what I actually had and how to explain what it was. But because you're meeting new people and people's attention span is quite, like, if you're on a date and you're having a drink, people's attention span isn't the same. You know?
You're like, here's my medical history.
Yeah. And, like, my medical history is hilarious. I just want to tell this quick story. So I remember I went to the doctor. So I'd come out to my mom and it didn't go well. And I went to the doctor, and I remember, like, years. So basically he said, oh, you need to speak to the stomach care nurse. But years later, mm-hmm. I read the medical report, and they always have like diagnosis, and it said, I am a gay. And I just thought it was the funniest thing ever. I showed it to my mom.
Your official medical
history.
Record.
I should put that up on my Instagram. It's so funny.
Oh my god. Oh yes. Frame it.
Yes. It could be like my wallpaper on my phone. I'm a gay.
Part of me is just like, maybe that doctor was really busy and, like, typed stuff up really fast, or maybe they were just very uncomfortable and didn't know what to write.
It was definitely, like, strange, but he was my doctor for, like, at that point, like, probably like 16 years. So it was a bit strange just write down, I am a gay.
It's not even grammatically correct, but maybe it is.
It became part of the story, so.
Somebody asked, did you have any issues with partners that weren't considerate or accepting of the sex life limitations?
Yeah, so I've definitely had people that have just been like, oh, well, that's a shame. And then it's just ended. Like, relationships, before they've even become relationships, have definitely ended. And I've had, like, I remember, like, my first sort of real proper boyfriend was Verse, and when we broke up, we were talking about it, and I remember him sort of saying, like, oh, I just feel like gay guys, like, really should be Verse, and they should, like, want to experience the best of both worlds. And I was like, are you shaming me for not being able to do this? Because that's kind of like, you know what you're saying to me, right? Like, it just felt very, the way he said it felt very, like, almost resentful. And I was like, you know, we've been together for a year, and, like, that probably wasn't the best way to say that. So I have had experiences where people, like, it's just ended the relationship, you know? And yeah, I've had people sticking their finger up my bum after I specifically say, you know, like, if they do it and they don't know, I'm like, fine. But then obviously, like, my sexual drive just, like, plummets, like, because I've got that association with the trauma of the sort of, like, the enemas. I don't, like it, but I also don't like the sensation, really.
Yeah. Do you have any examples, I guess, of times where it's gone well? Like, what has been, like, a really good thing that somebody has said or done in response to you telling them, like, hey, I can't be the receiver here?
So my last boyfriend was, like, amazing. And so, like, I was suffering at the time really bad anxiety. I was in Vancouver, and we had met up, and basically we went for, like, a drink, and then I found out he didn't drink, so he just got chicken wings, which was a bit strange, me sitting there having a pint of cider and him having chicken wings. And then it was just like, it was just really natural. And then I remember, like, I was quite stressed out at the time, and I remember, like, when he met up with me, he brought me a hot chocolate, and he just listened, and he just kind of got it. And there was things like, if he knew I was uncomfortable, he'd hold my hand. Like there was little things, like he was really like, he was like, what I needed was a sort of a guy that was a little bit less emotional than I was. And he was able to just see things and be able to kind of understand, you know, and in the bedroom and stuff like that. So like, I didn't feel comfortable. Like I didn't feel uncomfortable going to the toilet, let's say, like, you know, and worrying about him hearing or smelling it or anything like that, which was like huge for me. And in terms of it going badly, I remember there was a guy. So when I moved to London, so I moved to do my master's around 2012. And I remember, like, I just was like, oh, I really like want to like just meet like a real, I don't know, I want that sort of like love, actually sort of romance. Although it was like amazing, like, actually, but you know, I wanted something like that. And I remember just like thinking, oh, it'd be amazing. And I met this guy who was like just really interesting and like amazing. And we dated quite a few times. And I remember your walk, I was like, oh, I'll walk you back to your place and stuff like that, because I can kind of get the bus anywhere. So kind of like walking through Kingston. And I remember telling him and saying, like, you know, like I remember there was a point at which like I went to say goodbye to him and he ran back and kissed me. And he's like, sorry, I should have done that from the start. And that was our first kiss. And there was those moments and I was like, oh. And then when I told him, he was like, oh, he's like, I only top. He's like, I don't like bottoming. And then that was off. And then our friendship just gradually, like, we became friends, but it gradually just like grew apart. And it was really sad because he was a good guy. But yeah, he was like someone I was really smitten with, and it just broke my heart.
Yeah. It's so interesting because, like, part of me wants to be like, people just know what they want sexually. And like, there is such a thing as two people not being sexually compatible. Like, that is a thing. And if you're not sexually compatible, you have to kind of decide if you like, if that's like it, right? Yes. But on the other hand, I'm just like, oh, but try. But maybe he already tried, who knows, you know?
Yeah, it's he did try before, and I don't think he really kind of liked it. And like, I kind of respect that, like, that's his decision. Like, and I respect someone that just says like, look, you know, but it was just like, really, it was kind of sad not to have him in my life at all, even as a friend, because he was such a cool guy, you know. But I guess it's kind of difficult, isn't it, when sometimes when like a relationship hasn't ended because like it was amicable on both sides and there is still kind of sexual feeling there, it's supposed quite like difficult to like know how to navigate that, because it hasn't died down because you're both just like, oh, we've worked better as friends. It's actually, well, no, we are very much sexually attracted to each other and generally attracted to each other, but this feeling will always be there even as friends.
Yeah. And that sexual incompatibility in terms of like what you want to do and what you can do gets in the way, unfortunately.
No, it's sucks. It's sad, but, you know, like, it's like I'm alive, you know, and I'm healthy, so like I have to like remind myself when I'm feeling those moments where things are quite dark that, you know, well, actually, you know, there's people out there that have this illness and don't know they have it, you know.
Yeah. And it's quite rare, isn't it, you said?
Yeah, I don't think there's an official, like, there's, in Ireland and England, I don't think there's an official sort of, like, figure, but I want to say that it's, like, 1 in 50,000 people, approximately, in the States, but I think it might even be closer to, like, 1 in 100,000, but, like, and I think that's general polyposis. I don't even think that's familial, where it's passed genetically, because I feel like that adds another layer. It's, like, if you get polyposis, and it's, like, I guess, not given to you by a family member, which sounds, I don't mean that to, my mum might listen to this, I'm sorry, mum, but it's kind of like difficult, because you then, it kind of presents issues in the relationships that you have with family and can kind of strengthen it, but also throw in some sort of spanners into the dynamic.
Yeah. I wondered, to kind of like round us off, like, for anyone who is maybe gay, queer, and also ill as a teenager or a young person, do you have any like words of advice or comforting words for people who maybe are experiencing something similar or have been through something similar?
So for me, writing the story was very therapeutic. I would say if you need to talk to somebody, like I have at the moment cognitive behavioral therapy, which really, really helps. I think there's such a stigma around therapy and I need it for me. And I've kind of talked a little bit about the illness as well. And I think sometimes that can really help if you're able to avail of that or just talk to somebody. If you're going to date somebody, just remember that, like, you know, if there's something that limits your sexual experience, whether it be by illness or not, it is always your decision. And, you know, you have a voice. Don't be afraid to say, I don't like that. Or, you know, don't be afraid to be like, if you want to be upfront with someone and that's the best like method for you, then you do that. If you want to wait a couple of dates, if you want to wait a while, like nobody can force that information out of you. But just make sure that whatever you're doing, you're looking after kind of like your physical well-being, but also your mental and emotional well-being is so important. And don't be afraid to like, yeah, if there's forums and things like that, that you can kind of just get advice. There are definitely forums out there, depending on the kind of chronic illness you have. Just, it might just be nice to talk to other people and just see how they kind of manage.
I've definitely found that helpful, like talking to other people with the with like a stoma and stuff definitely helps. Thank you, Chris. That's so wonderful. And that's such, such great advice as well. What is your book called and where can people find it? And also, where can people find more of you online?
So the book is called Gut Feelings. So it is a verse novel and it explores obviously my chronic illness and sort of my sexuality. You can buy it, should be able to buy it from bookstores, but they're closed. So I'd say like Amazon, Book Depository, Hive. If you can support independence, like bookshop.org, and particularly Hive. Hive supports independence. And as far as I know, you don't have to spend the minimum to get free standard delivery. So if you could support Hive or bookshop.org, that would be wonderful. And you can, and you can find me. So I'm YA Fictionados on Twitter and Karmic Chris on Instagram. And I do pole dancing. So just, be aware that if you want to Karmic
Chris. Oh my God, really?
Yeah, I do a lot of pole
dancing. This comes up right at the end. I have more questions now.
Well, actually, funnily, I'll say it real quick, but like, yeah, when I lost the swimming, I feel like I took on the pole dancing in my 20s, and it's just been amazing to have something that's so out there and something that I enjoy. And I actually obviously have to show my body, so it means I'm more comfortable with my body. But yeah.
That is honestly so cool, because also I'm like trying to like filter through all my memories now, and I don't even think I've ever seen a male pole dancer.
Yeah, there is a lot of them. There's one in particular who just is, that's, I'll send you like a link, but his name is Dmitry Politov. I believe he's Russian and he does all these flags and stuff, but he does them off like bridges in Europe and like from like 150 feet up in the air and on off the 15th floor of like an apartment block, like where if he let go, he'd be dead. And I guess it's insane.
Wow.
I
love that. Oh my goodness. We'll have to check the pole dancing videos as well as your book Gut Feelings. Well, thank you so much, Chris. This has been an absolute joy. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you so much for having me, Hannah, and hopefully people find it useful.
Thank you all for listening. Bye. Thank you so much for listening to Doing It. If you enjoyed it, I would really appreciate it if you left a rating and a review. You can find show notes at doingitpodcast.co.uk and do go follow us on social media, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye. This was a Global Original podcast.